Hello, everyone. I want to welcome you to a presentation comparing two different approaches on PCI compliance, which I'm particularly very interested in. The presenters, we have three from Baylor, John Allen, who is the ISO there, Bob Hartland, who is the AVP for Security and IT Servers and Networks, and Adam Seeley, who's the Senior Information Security Analyst. And then from the University of Delaware is Scott Swearin, who's the ISO there. They have a lot of information to pack in today, and so what we're going to do is start with Delaware and then end with Baylor, and then we're going to hold questions until the end. So I also want to welcome the online audience and remind everyone to complete the evaluations. Hey, Scott.
Good afternoon. Everybody still awake? So what I'm going to do here today between the two of us is we're going to present two different approaches to PCI DSS on how our schools have tried to comply with the standard. So the two approaches are insourcing versus outsourcing. So by insourcing, meaning keeping systems on your network, doing what you have to do to comply. Outsourcing being find third-party vendors, get it in the cloud, remove the data, whatever you have to do. So I just want to try and liven it up a little bit. Show of hands, who has actually gone through an effort to be PCI compliant? Okay, just about every hand. Anybody taken the insourcing approach? Outsourcing approach. So no insourcing. Looks like you're a minority, I'm sorry. So real quick, a little bit about the University of Delaware. So bear with me. This is the marketing slides that my marketing guys gave me. So we have students, we teach classes, and we have campuses, okay? Does that work for you? just a quick little history about PCI and where we're at. So as you know, it's a standard that's mandated by the card brands. It's been around since 2001. Most people are surprised to see that it's been around quite that long. The new version 2.0 of PCI DSS has been around since just January this year. So although it's a major change, the differences are somewhat subtle. That's not what you would expect out of a major change, but that's not the topic of the discussion today. In UD's case, the change to 2.0 is going to be effective the next time we need to report compliance, which in our case is December. So we had to report this past December, we report next December, and we'll be reporting against the new standards, where in December we were reporting against 1.2 of the standard. We are a level three, which means we do a self-assessment questionnaire. And our date's, as I said, December 31. Real quick, level set. Scope is anything that stores, processes, or transmits credit card data or cardholder data. So you decided that we don't want to do that. So we outsourced everything. The way we looked at it is if you take a look at the standard, and this is 1.2. I haven't actually updated this to see if there's any new documentation required for 2.0. that by not having the data on the network, everything with a line drawn through it is probably documentation we don't need to have. So we don't have to worry about firewall rules and how we manage them if there's no systems that are being protected by firewalls. It's an NA, not applicable. So that was the advantage to us. Based upon the culture and the environment the university is or was at that time, these things would have been a drastic change in how we operate and how we do IT. So by not having to do them at all, we didn't have to change make major change to our operating procedures. So a little bit of history. 2008, the first year that our bank came to us and said you need to worry about PCI compliance. And at that time, we were defined at a level four. Does anybody not understand the levels, 1, 2, 3, 4? Okay. So to give you an idea, we were the difference between a 4 and a 3 is at 20,000 transactions a year. We were at 19,000 and change in 2008. So a modest increase in transactions put us into a level three. Of course, a lot of the talks I've had on campus was, well, when will you become a level two? Like, not for a long time. That's a million, by the way. So as a four, we didn't really have a requirement for scanning because that was really based at the time on the bank's decision on what was required and not required. Same thing with the SAQ. We didn't really have to do anything. But what we did on campus is we had each of the merchants, the people that held a merchant account, attest to their compliance. And in 2009, I think it was 3 days after my first day at the university, we got the letter saying we'd been changed. And for the reason that is particularly funny is my job before being a CSO at University of Delaware is I was a PCI QSA. I worked for TrustWave specifically and at Fortrex before that. So they were kind of thankful that we had now a QSA on staff, so to speak. Our plan was get the prohibited data attestation in by September 30th, which we did. Fortunately, the way we were doing things, we were not in conflict with that worksheet, so that was an easy one to fill out. Filling out the SAQ by December 31 was a little bit more problematic for us. This is how our environment looked at the time. We took credit cards in four different ways. We had dial-up terminals, which effectively didn't need a whole lot of change. It's basically as long as the credit card numbers are not being printed on any receipt, there's very little you have to do with the dial-up terminal. We had network-connected computers. And the three we listed there, Vita Nova is a restaurant ran by our School of Hotel and Restaurant and Institutional Management. So it's ran by the students and the faculty. It's not a restaurant for the students to eat in the cafeteria. It's actually a 4 or 5 star. It's fine dining. We had athletic ticket sales because we have a football team and a basketball team and lacrosse team and soccer team and all that. And we want to sell tickets for people to see those things. And PCS is our professional continuing studies. So where we didn't take credit cards for tuition at this point in time, we did for continuing studies for credit courses, for certificate courses and things like that. We also had a lot of card not present type of things. And that would be a college wants to put a conference up, so they put a PDF form up on a website that says print this out, fill out the form, fax it in, mail it in, something like that. So the form was online, but you didn't complete it online. You just printed it and sent it in. And then we had web-based. And we used it in two different ways. We had an engine we called Web Credit, which was our in-house developed e-commerce option, which is how if you wanted a form developed to take credit cards for the sale of something, we went to our internal development group. We call them ITWD, IT Web Development, and they would create a form for you, and that would go through Web Credit. The fortunate thing for us is from at least the days I got there, this was all centralized. So we didn't have independent groups creating their own forms on the web where we had to bring them in. All access to our merchant accounts went through our finance department, and finance department only let the web development group develop forms. We also had UDMART, which is our on-campus purchasing system for services from other parts of the campus. We have a graphics department, for example, so if you wanted a poster printed, you could call the graphics department. They charged your budget. The way they charged your budget was with the credit card number. They didn't actually charge the credit card. They just used the number to determine what accounting code you were in. It never actually hit the credit card statement. It didn't go through the credit card system, nothing. So what we did, like I said, we outsourced everything. Dial-up terminals didn't need to do much. We also have a hotel, part of HRIM again, but that was completely outsourced to a group called Shaner. So they were not on our network. Shaner took care of the compliance. It really was out of sight, out of mind for us. It was nothing we had to worry about. The development office, the people that raise money, what they did is outsourced to a company called Ruffalo Cody. So we took a little part of our network, segmented it off, put a firewall in front of it. Ruffalo Cody manages that. They maintain the compliance. Our graduate admissions, not undergrad, but graduate admissions, also decided to outsource. We went to a company called Hobson's. Now the system's not on our network at all. When you click the apply, you get taken over to apply yourself at Hobson's. You fill out the application, you pay your application fee. I think the deposit goes through them as well, and you're done. UD Bookstore was outsourced Barnes & Noble. The terminals are dial-up inside the system, so it wasn't on the network. That was easy. Dining is Aramark for us, so that was another easy one. They were just using dial-up terminals. They have a nice computer system in the cafeteria, and then they had the little slide thing, and you stand there and wait in line for the credit card thing to authorize. It's a great system. For compliance, not so much for students. So web credit was really the thing that was left, and how did we deal with it, and that was outsourcing it. We chose CashNet. Is anybody here from TouchNet? No. Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, you're not. Okay. Cut CashNet, who is TouchNet, one of TouchNet's competitors who sponsors this conference. So, partly why it doesn't say it on the slide. So our procurement system, this is the folks that had using the credit card number for UDMART and whatnot. These are the steps that they took to get rid of it. We got rid of the number from our system and our ERP, so it's no longer using that. We went to GL codes, which is ultimately where the money needed to go to in the first place. We also had in the past, if we printed a purchase order, would print the credit card number of the person ordering out for the vendor to fulfill and then charge the credit card. So we removed that. We now only store the last four digits of the credit card number. The vendor has it on file on their side. They use the last four just to make sure nothing changed, nothing and validate the card. The reporting was changed. PCI only allows for the first six and last four digits of the credit card number to be displayed. We were doing the last six, so we shortened it to last four. But what we did do is add the employee ID, so if anybody came up with a duplicate last four, the tiebreaker was the ID. The last two really weren't PCI, but it's something we did while we were in there making changes anyway. When we did reports and anything that touched vendor management, we were printing their EIN, or in a lot of cases that was their SSN if it was an independent contractor. So we stopped that practice. We came up with an auto numbering system. Our ERP is PeopleSoft. It had the ability just to create numbers on the fly. We went with those numbers. The system still has to store the numbers so it can do the 1099 process at the end of the year. But at least the SSNs now aren't on reports. They're not on screens. They're only really being handled that one time a year, which is about now. And we also went through and deactivated any vendor that didn't have any activity for 18 months to even shorten the number of vendors that you could even troll through. There is an activation process if you want to use a vendor that hasn't been used in a while. So that was from the procurement side. The UDMART was the system we were using for purchasing from outside vendors that we have a relationship with, things like Staples and Office Max and Dell and those kind of folks. When they retired UDMART in favor of all these changes, they renamed it the Blue Hen Market. What we did is got rid of the credit card numbers, as I mentioned. And the purchasing stuff that I described a little bit earlier, and they retired the Blue Hen Market. So now what we did is worked with the vendors to give them the credit card numbers in an offline kind of way. If they store it, the assumption is they're PCI compliant. It's their responsibility to secure the data. We don't have it anymore. One thing to note, and the reason I'm bringing this up, as a former QSA, it's always been my interpretation that all credit card numbers are in scope. So if you issue credit cards to your employees, your staff, your faculty, for travel, for whatever they do, and you store those credit card numbers somewhere in your system, an HR system because it's associated with their profile, or some kind of purchasing system, they're in scope. Real quick. Unless your card brand tells you otherwise. How's that? It's all subjective, but in general, the approach is they're in scope because it's still a credit card number, it can still be compromised. The difference is the brand has to bear the liability, so if they say they're not concerned, then not worry about it. We also had a procurement system for doing our business expense reimbursements for things like going to conferences like this. and it's a system from Bank of America called The Works. So that's how we outsource that. So now as charges come through, you just sign onto a web page hosted by Bank of America. There's all your charges, all your statement, all the credit card numbers, everything associated is sitting there, not on our system. What they do, Bank of America then, is sends us the last four digits of the P card, which is we call the credit card number that was signed to an employee, and the Apple ID, which is our term for our employee IDs, to UD, so that we know whose charges are whose for accounting-wise and into our general ledger system. Athletics was using an internal system that was Paciolan by Ticketmaster. That application has been retired in favor of Ticketmaster's Arctix, which is a completely hosted application. That environment is very similar to Ruffalo Cody, segment of our network, firewall in front of it. It's part of Arctix or Ticketmaster's network at that point. It's their compliance requirement. The restaurant was using, or still is using Micro software. If you're familiar with that, it's a very popular point of sale application, especially in the restaurant industry. So they're still using it. What we did is we just disabled the credit card capability. We had two terminals in the entire university that were for university-owned restaurants. It wasn't worth trying to get them compliant for two terminals, and they were 10 feet apart from each other. So we just put a dial-up terminal right next to the POS terminal. And that took at least those devices out of scope for PCI, and we had micros come in and turn off the credit card feature, so if they hit credit card by accident, it says, sorry, we don't take credit cards. So this is where I was really trying to get to. So going with CashNet, and this is not a CashNet-specific thing, but here's some pros and cons that we found to outsourcing. Now, I said most of you outsource, so I'd be curious to see how many of you agree or disagree with this or have come across these same ones. The biggest advantage is it outsources the payment processing to somebody else. The nuts and bolts is really now somebody else's problem. It makes it easier for us to comply. If things aren't working, we just call them up and have them fix it. We don't have to spend our resources trying to debug a program. It also removes the need to bring all our systems into compliance. So the biggest issue for us wasn't so much the making sure patches were installed on time, making sure the logging. It actually was the SDLC. Our developers were not accustomed to working in an environment that was PCI compatible. If you look at the OWASP and the top 10 and the code reviews and the independents and the sign-offs and all, and the culture shock that would have brought probably was going to be more damaging than anything else we could have done. Yes, we could have created a subnet, put things on it, put a firewall. That's technology. That stuff was easy to do. But getting all these policies in place, getting people to actually do those things, that was the hard part. So we said, we're not going to try. With that comes the need to formally document policies and procedures. I don't know how many schools here are very diligent about keeping their policies current and ensuring your environments follow those policies and, you know, you're following all your procedures to the letter and everybody is on board, or is it a challenge to keep people on track with the policies and procedures and saying this is what you should do and actually getting them to do it. So, and even from a system support. So, again, managing a firewall is easy. Getting a firewall admin to put in a change request before he changes a rule every single time he does it, that was hard. I've talked about the software development. And now it also just removes the whole need to manage the system. So although the technology part of it was relatively simple, now we don't have to worry about it. But with all the things that we got, what it did require us to do is we had all these web forms that we were using for e-commerce. PCI side, there was nothing wrong with those forms. We didn't really need to touch them. We didn't need to do anything. But because we outsourced, we now had to touch every single form in some way, whether it was a minor modification or completely rewriting it. The biggest probably issue for us to meet our deadlines was the fact that it took 4 months for us to negotiate a contract instead of 3 or 4 weeks, I think, which was what was anticipated. Now, I think ours was a little special, and we were going to use a feature called Smart Pay, which lets us pass on the fees to somebody else, and that's where the negotiation wrangle came up. But that's what happened. Because it took 4 months longer to get the contract, we were actually sitting in June when that happened. Well, what happens in June with all your IT development staff? That's a good time to take vacation, right? So now you want to train people on a brand new product on how to use it. I can't get half the development staff to be in the room at the same time because one's, you know, they're at the beach or they're away, they're doing whatever they're doing. So that added another 2 months to the process. And then once they got trained, they still had to really get comfortable and learn how to use it. And then just as they were getting there, CashNet had a little power outage, which we lost, I think, a couple forms, and the things weren't saved. It took a while to go back and figure out, well, what's still there, what's not there. Some configuration things changed unexpectedly on us. In the middle of this, one of the staff members left. So now we're down a person. And we have also found that because we're using a third-party process, that the development process is a little bit slower. It's more cumbersome. It's a GUI interface to writing code where a lot of developers are used to a command line interface that can circumvent that. So, you know, it's taking us longer to do the equivalent than we did ourselves.
Before we go away from times, I want to look at the dial-up terminal.
Yes.
Because I know right now if we told people you can only use dial-up terminals, you know, they'd be after my head.
Yeah, the restaurant for us was a lunch buffet, so ringing up was very easy because the price was the same for everybody. The dinner crowd, they're only open up 3 days a week, mm-hmm. and only during the school year, so it's not a lot of traffic. It wasn't a major headache. When I sat with them and explained what the other options were, this is the option they chose.
So all your student dining facilities?
That's Aramark, yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
That's different. This is the, yeah, it's
your
it's. Yeah, I don't know. I think they can seat 40 or 50 people in the dining room. And, yeah, it's again fine dining, so they don't flip tables very fast.
And is Aramark also using dial-up?
Yes,
terminals?
Yes. But I'm going to get to that in a minute.
Cool.
So we have 3 options right now with CashNet, and I think Touch Network's the same way. We can do a vendor-hosted storefront, which is you completely create a form hosted on CashNet's webpage. Has everything you need. What's nice about it is it's all there. It can be. We have the ability to give management to the users. So if you have a group, a department, a faculty group that is relatively savvy with their development capability, since it's GUI, you can let them have some control over designing the forms and managing things, where with our internal forms, we didn't want them touching it. The other thing we picked up, which we didn't have in our forms, was inventory control. And where this was great is when they have a bus trip to New York City and there's only 30 seats on the bus, we now have a way of saying, you know, cut it off at 30. And they can also now use the CashNet for reporting, where we had to write reports for them. The CashNet's got a whole bunch of capability. They can customize their own reports. They can, whatever's out there, they can do it themselves. The checkout page is a little bit different. That's where we designed the form, and when you hit the Pay Now button, it redirects you over to CashNet. So you get a lot more flexibility because the bulk of the form, the things that are important on how the form's displayed, you have a lot more control over because you can make it look the way you want, and it gives you more control over the over the receipts and conditional variables, which is how it determines things like, for example, if you register for a PCS class, and this class, everybody gets a T-shirt, versus if you take this one, everybody gets a book. And those conditional kind of things, you got a lot more control over when you're doing them yourself. You also get better messaging capability, and the reporting tool, while it's adequate for CashNet for most users, we got a lot more flexibility there. There's also, I just noticed my numbers aren't 1, 2, 3. Yeah, isn't that interesting? I'll fix that before I put them up on the site. The transaction gateway is where you host everything. We only use this for non-credit card transactions, and we do have systems where we keep bank information on file. So if somebody wants to order something and just say charge it to the bank account on file, a transaction gateway is how we do that. And one of the examples we use it for is our student health system. We have your bank information from direct deposit. When you want to use, you want to get a trainer at the gym, you can just say, hey, just charge it to that account, and it'll just pull it. Here's some like non-PCI benefits. For, again, the non-technical folks, it is wizard-driven. So it's, you know, tell me the items, tell me the name of the merchant account, you know, which logo do you want to use, and here's five to choose from, and that sort of thing. Again, I mentioned the inventory control, some of the reporting. The other thing we picked up is the ability to charge customers credit card fees. And for those of you who said, but that's in violation of the operating regs of the vendor, there is some loopholes you can get around. We use a processor called Comerica, where Comerica charges a handling charge for the convenience of the transaction. And so if they have a tuition bill for $1,000, Comerica says, for the convenience of using your credit card, we'll handle that transaction for you for a measly $25, and they get billed $1,025. We get our $1,000. So, it's a flat rate. It's calculated based upon the charges. It's a dynamic rate. So the steps we took the one policy we still needed was a service provider engagement policy. That's almost done. Complete the conversion of all the forms over, submit our prioritized approach worksheet. The reason we had to do that is because December came along, we hadn't converted all the forms yet. At this point in time, Visa and MasterCard were not fining companies for not being in compliant if they were showing a concerted effort to achieving compliance. The way you show that concerted effort is submit a prioritized approach worksheet, which is available on the web. I can show you a copy if you want to see it, with estimated completion dates. So we put that out there. We have the dates out there. Our bank accepted that. When we do finally get compliant, we'll submit an SAQ at that point in time, and then our cycle picks up where it was originally in December. We don't delay our schedule by that time. So now we just got to meet those dates. So I say all this, and then we came across an instance where we had to bring it on-site because parking wanted to put kiosks in the garage for self-service, and dining doesn't like the dial-ups. Imagine that. They're tired of seeing 20 people in a hallway or in a room trying to get up. And we were also talking about getting DVD kiosks. You know, if you've seen those red box, this was a different brand. Actually, I can't remember the brand because they decided to put phone lines in there after all. So. I don't know if you can read this. This is how we opted to do it. I don't have a ton of time. Maybe at the Q&A time we can go over this in more detail. But we're creating a series of VPN networks within our network to isolate and segment what needs to be compliant with what doesn't. The issue here for us was unconventionally you would put a lot of this on a VLAN or on a segment and then protect that and can manage it. But because these are kiosks and cash registers which are distributed throughout the campus, we have a geography issue and that I need to get a network connection from the parking garage and from the dining hall over here. By the way, we have 12 sites that we sell dining services and 4 garages. So I have 16 physically, geographically dispersed sites that I need to get a network signal to get them out to the internet somehow. So one idea was, why don't we just give them Fios accounts or Comcast accounts? You know, times 12 or 15, that gets expensive. So we decided to go with this approach and utilize the core internet infrastructure. We are taking the approach that UD is an ISP. So our handoff point for compliance is where those departments connect to our network, not where we connect to the internet. So that keeps everything out of scope. We can talk more about that in the QA. I just mentioned it. And that's my talk. I'm going to turn it over to Baylor at this point in time.
We're going to try to, as mentioned earlier, if we can kind of hold the questions. questions to the end would be helpful, and I imagine we might get majority of the questions since we seem to be the more unique of the two. So anyway, as Scott said, we are a university. We teach students. Actually, we're just 3.5-4 hours up the road, I-35. Largest Baptist university in the world. We have about 14,000 students. And we are, I guess to sum up the PCI issue, we are usually choose to be very conservative in our approaches. So one thing I do say every time we do talk to a group is that what we're going to be describing, what brain trust behind me is going to be describing, is what works for Baylor. A couple things I learned from PCI is that it means a lot different things to a lot of different people. Some you can't even say because it's inappropriate. But it is a disease in my estimation. It will infect anything it touches. So you hear the concept of isolating and stuff like that. So it has been a challenge. Other words you'll listen to or hear a lot of, interpretation and the role of a QSA. QSA is going to be very important to any efforts that you do and that you're in sync with that individual and what you're doing. We don't claim to be QSAs. We obviously promote the idea of you getting your own when you invoke or when you embark on this journey or challenge. I'll say challenge. One thing I do like to say, though, is how we're structured. It's important, especially we found out with this PCI compliance issue, it's important that there's a lot of collaborative efforts. In our organization, our security is we house with our data group, our server group, our voice networking group, so there's a lot of collaborative effort. If they want to talk to someone in those areas, it's just the cube right next door to them. They report to me directly, and then I report to our CIO, and then ultimately to our vice president. Now, obviously, John and his group gets pinged a lot from general counsel, the president's office, and they obviously have direct access to John and his group. They don't have to go through me. But this structure has worked out very well for us in terms of a collaborative effort. So with that, I will hand it off to John.
So I think one of the first questions that always comes up when we start talking about PCI is, why is it so hard in higher education? Everybody seems to be able to grasp and handle PCI compliance in the enterprise, and I think there's a lot of reasons for that we are helped by peeling back a bit. One of the first reasons is there is a lot of different ways that we tend to take credit cards on campuses. When you look at us, we're much closer to being a city than any single financial entity or business or store. In a lot of cases, those places only have a few ways of taking credit cards. When we peeled back our institution, we found more than 60 ways that credit cards were being taken as you looked across the entire institution. So as a result, that makes it really hard to come in and say, okay, and now we're going to make this all compliant. The other thing, like any other security initiative, it's very difficult to show a return on investment when you're talking about PCI compliance. You can always wave the stick and say, they're going to come in and say, we can't process credit cards anymore. And everybody looks at their peers and they laugh at you and say, oh, they'll just fine us, it'll be okay. So you've got to kind of figure out, how are you going to illustrate and show, while we're doing PCI compliance, we're also going to raise the bar of IT security around this information and give a better value to our customers and who we're dealing with. Scope conversations are extremely complex. We have found it so easy for student organizations, for different individuals, to stand up a website and all of a sudden be taking credit cards on the university's behalf before we even realize what's happening. And I think one of the things that we quickly realize as we go through and talk through these conversations is, as you talk about scope and what everyone's doing, awareness becomes huge. So one of the key things you need to do is figure out your level. One of the key points I try to point out is level doesn't change the requirements for compliance. So the PCI DSS doesn't change as a result of what level you are. What does change is the validation that you have to go through. So I think a lot of people concentrate a lot on that level stuff, and I think really the key point is that's just once you get done and you're talking about validation. That's not going to affect your actual implementation of the requirements to meet PCI compliance. The compliance piece, when you go back and try to do the verification, a ROC versus an SAQ, we've talked to quite a few institutions. There's some very small institutions that go ahead and do a ROC, where they have an external QSA come in, do a full evaluation, they end up with a written document that the QSA is backing, saying that, yes, they're PCI compliant. Organizations that are really looking to guarantee and shift that risk in some respect of their compliance find that very comfortable, and they want to go through and spend that money. A lot of institutions are fine with the self-assessment questionnaire. Keep in mind that your officer that is signing this document is actually attesting this is accurate. So you want to make sure when you fill out the SAQ that it truly reflects your environment, because you do have a signature that's going on that is holding that is actually what you say it's going to be. We found a lot of different implementations when we talked to higher education institutions, varying from PCI doesn't really apply to us to almost bank implementations. I mean, very, very strict implementations across higher ed. Probably the people that are doing that type of implementation are in the handful right now, but the more we're talking to schools, because of things getting insourced back in, and all of a sudden people want point of sale systems, and they want new technology, and they want those credit cards to be handled through their systems, it's much harder to do the separation. Ownership of the process. This was very key. About 2.5, 3 years ago, IT security was kind of flagging, hey, PCI is really important, guys. We need to be talking about this. And everybody kind of said, yeah, we can talk about this at some point. And then finally, about 2 years ago, we got the ear of our associate vice president over finances, and he's also the treasurer, and the processing bank had started contacting him saying, knock, knock, are you guys PCI compliant? Knock, knock, are you PCI compliant? And all of a sudden, it started to ring true that, oh, this is something we're really going to have to tackle. We're going to have to talk about this. And fortunately for us, they didn't look to IT security and say, you guys own this process. They looked to us as a partner. So they actually took ownership of this process. I think that's very key when you talk about PCI compliance. You actually need somebody who is an owner. And then there's roles within that. For instance, our role is to help with technology compliance, some of the policies around the technology compliance, and then some of the pieces that come with verification of that compliance. Another piece, the cashier's controller's office, play a huge role in this process because they're the ones that actually have access to the merchant IDs and know who can process credit card transactions. The network infrastructure, and some of the other pieces we're going to talk about here in a minute, so I'm going to kind of skip over that for time. Establishment of the PCI committee. So rather than just having 3 or 4 individuals in a room who made all the decisions for campus on PCI, we actually brought together a fairly large group that involved a lot of the different constituent groups on campus. So athletics had a huge role in credit card processing, so they have a seat at the table. Same side, financial side. They've got a lot of people involved in this stuff, so we have them with a seat at the table. Development has a big piece of the pie when it comes to credit card transactions. And we found that as we sit at the table and talk and have these conversations about what are the issues in the different departments, it's amazing the other things that start bubbling up, and you start realizing, oh, you know, we do this. Is that a problem? And you start having these conversations and kind of becoming a group where your one focus goal is to become PCI compliant. And it's amazing how much you can get done. And all of a sudden, the people that maybe had been adversarial to PCI originally are now the ones going out there advocating it within their own divisions. And that's one of the things you want to make sure is that you've got people that are advocating on your behalf of, we need to identify where is that cardholder data? How are we paying for this? How are we handling credit cards related to this? Members need to be able to speak authoritatively for their departments on these topics. So you don't want somebody who's just an administrative assistant in a division to be coming and saying, I'm the PCI representative. You want to make sure you have somebody that's at such a level that they can make decisions for the given division. That's been really important for us because we can sit there at the table, and if this person says it, we know that that's how it's going to be implemented within the department, and we're going to be able to move forward with that. One of the other benefits that we have is we have some great internal IT auditors and auditors, and they really grasped onto this, and early on, did what I would call a small overview of our credit card environment, and what they peeled back and were able to bring to the table in just that overview shocked people. They were absolutely stunned with the amount of credit card processing that took place, with the volumes that were being done, and some of the card handling practices, to be quite honest with you, just were archaic. It just didn't make sense, the things that were being done. Identifying usage. You've got to get your mind around, where are the cards being used, why, and how. The why is interesting. We found situations where people were taking credit cards, much like Scott mentioned a few minutes ago, and maybe they weren't even charging them right away. We're holding onto this credit card in case they don't bring this hearing aid back to us. So we're going to do copies of cardholder data and retain that just in case. Well, it's an expensive device. I understand that, but let's not hold cardholder data. There's a better way to approach this problem. So understanding the business case, making sure you understand why the credit cards are being taken, how the credit cards are being taken, those are big questions. And I think as you peel those back, you find amazingly interesting stories, because there's a lot of history. You know, the department that first took credit cards on campus probably wasn't doing it electronically. And when they decided to go electronically, well, probably the online methods that were available at that time weren't really PCI compliant. And in all likelihood, departments don't go around just looking to change processes because they want to. They change processes because they're asked to. So we found a lot of those older processes around where things just didn't make sense. Couple other things we want to talk about is the telephone transactions. We have a lot of situations. Private university have a tendency to do a little bit of hand-holding at times, and you know, an alumnus calls up and wants to make a donation. We're not going to tell them no to accepting their credit card over the phone. And you have to realize that those things are going on in your department, where you may go ahead and outsource. And I'll say we use TouchNet, and a lot of our stuff is done through TouchNet. But as soon as you have that computer on the desk and the person says, oh, sure, I can pull up that form and fill it out on your behalf, you can have a huge scope issue that you need to be addressing, and realize that that type of customer service can really change where you sit as regards to PCI scope and PCI DSS compliance. Merchant IDs. It's a very important piece of this process. We found that we had, I think it ended up being somewhere between 25 and 30 merchant IDs for campus, and were used in all kinds of different systems, some hosted. So don't think just because a system's hosted that it isn't something that could be in your scope, because if it's your merchant ID and that contract does not accept PCI DSS risk, which a lot of them do not, you can have another issue there. So you want to make sure to understand, where are our merchant IDs and how are they being used? One of the things we did once the auditor came back with the report and all of our jaws were on the table and we said, okay, we've really got to tackle this problem, we brought a QSA in. The QSA did a gap analysis. This is not a technical engagement for the most part. This is going out and talking to the departments, doing interviews, researching merchant IDs, understanding what is going on with the people out there in the departments. The feet on the floor is what I like to say. You know, you're walking out there, you're saying, show me how you're processing credit cards. Walk me through this process. Help me understand what's going on. And then they may come back and ask technical questions at some point to say, you know, hey, they've got this little server over there. Were you guys aware of that? Did you know that they're doing such and such for that? And we go, no, didn't really realize that. Okay. So don't just kind of take the surface level piece of, well, they say they're doing the right thing. And I've talked to a lot of schools that have kind of gone with the approach of, well, we ask the department if they're PCI compliant, and they say yes, and so we accept that. We found out very quickly that what the department considered okay and what the university who was going to be signing the self-assessment questionnaire found to be okay were very, very different. So be aware of that. I mean, just getting a yes from somebody who has very little risk and skin in the game may not be the best approach to getting your PCI compliance. What we're going to now talk about, Adam's going to talk about the follow-up to the PCI QSA engagement that we had and kind of the ongoing technical solutions that we're using to meet PCI compliance.
Okay, so you're more than halfway done with your PCI tour for today, but it's an hour and a half, just so if you need to get up and leave, feel free. So after we picked our jaws off the floor, after the gap analysis, and oh my goodness, we have this everywhere, what are we going to do? We got together and we said, okay, let's come up with a strategy of how we're going to separate out our stuff. Where can we outsource? Where do we have to deal with it ourselves? How are we going to modify these applications? And so we came up with an initial plan, which is when I started getting involved, an initial plan of how we were going to segment our network off, very similar. We use VLANs across campus instead of VPN, but a similar deal where we're getting full segmentation, not network segmentation, but isolation for our PCI stuff out. So after we came up with this big plan and got some budgetary numbers approved and this and that, we brought the QSA back in and said, hey, here's what we're planning on doing. How's this look? Right? It's good? And it wasn't so good. It was better than some of the stuff we were doing, but there were holes found. And so I'll talk through a little bit of that process. But all this to say, meeting with the QSA isn't just a do a gap analysis and then do your ROC. It's do your gap analysis and then keep them engaged through the process. Because the last thing you want is to outlay all this money and then find out, oh, well, you missed one little thing or one thing wasn't so clear, and then you have to go back and re-architect it. So I encourage that. So what is scope? It's not a fun thing to talk about, but basically any people, process, technology, which it's interesting to think that people are in scope according to the document, but the things that they do are in scope when they're storing the cardholder data, which our policy is we won't store cardholder data in electronic form. If you need to store it paper-wise, you can document it and lock it in a cabinet. That's good. But we won't store it electronically. And then the other two are processes or transmits. And so these are the people that are taking the credit card and swiping. These are the people answering the phone saying, yes, Mr. Donor, I will take your money on behalf of Baylor. Click, click, click. Those are all in scope and need to be addressed at different levels. So obviously, logging of a phone call may be a little different from logging of a transaction, and how you're dealing with encryption on the network can make different changes. But these things are the in scope environment, and that needs to be handled differently. Now, in higher ed, more than in most, so like a Taco Bell, for example, all the computers in the Taco Bell can be in scope quite easily. They all accept credit cards. They're all POS, and then it's done. But in ours, we really can't have our student computers in scope, or our email systems, or our Active Directory infrastructure, or maybe, you know, there's different levels of that. So you need to, we found out that it was almost a new area of really breaking that line between scope, in scope and out of scope. Which is so critical in higher ed. So as I was talking about our costs, we came up with our initial budget figures and then had the QSA come back in, and we had to revise the budget figures. And some of the things that we were talking about is things to consider. So this is just kind of this is our journey, some things that we found out, things to consider as you're going along. Staff resources, project management, that's mostly me from the technical side of making sure that we have all the pieces in together, as well as the technical resources. So it costs money, also known as you can't do as much other things with your technical resources if PCI is taking half of their time. So you need to be aware that you will have networking resources that need to be allocated, and server person resources, and telephone, and then I don't worry about the finance people. But from the technical side, there are resources you need to have. And then there's the initial money that you have to get, as well as stuff moving forward. So as the requirements change, you're going to have to modify your environment perhaps. You need operating costs to make sure you're keeping up with the latest tools and upgrades and those types of things. So in our environment, which I'm about to show, so we're a level 3 merchant. We've already talked about merchant levels. We have about 25 merchant IDs, which are being used around. And we are very, very conservative. We're a Baptist school, so surely we're conservative, but we definitely slide on the conservative side of risk, especially the people who are going to be signing their names on the yes, we're compliant to Wells Fargo, the finance people. They're quite conservative, and so it kind of got to this chain of, well, I'm not going to sign it until someone underneath me says that's good. And it rolled down to me, and I said, well, I'm not going to sign it. I wouldn't sign it unless I had a QSA say it was good. So that's our environment, but it may not be yours. You just need to understand where your risk tolerance and appetite for dealing with what happens if your bank says sorry, or you have an issue and they start slapping you with big fines because you didn't do it right. Is that acceptable? in your area. And the other thing is we've had to go back and revise some of our relationships with external vendors, making sure that they're saying that they're PCI compliant. So anyone who does business with Baylor and accepts credit cards while on campus or anywhere associated with Baylor, we've added a contract addendum which says that you are PCI compliant and you've done the right things. We also chose to do a completely segmented, isolated network, hard line. We were building out command and control infrastructure around campus as it was when PCI happened. So we were getting these other VLANs popping up in our buildings because we've got athletics and development and dining services and all that everyone else has. Since we had command and control there, this is just another command and control VLANs where we're plugging those things in, but those get segmented off. They don't get routed with the rest of the traffic. They go in. You'll see. I'm going to draw some pictures. Okay, so this is what we looked like before we took the gap analysis. I tried to put cutesy pictures, but your registers and regular computers are on the campus network. Campus networks. We didn't have any registers in the server networks, but that's where our micros backends were located. And so any PCI traffic went this route, and then the parts that went out to authorization went out to the internet. So in our analysis, this whole thing is in scope. Goodness gracious, we can't have all of campus in scope, so what are we going to do? So we have this concept of, I'm going to turn this guy on so I can turn around and talk. This line of scopeness, where we don't want campus to be all of campus to be in scope, but there's going to have to be some that is. So we came up with these zone concepts. And the zone concepts were how we tried to limit scope from creeping further and further. It's kind of an infectious disease, as Bob mentioned, where you have, if I have a device which I'm swiping credit cards on, clearly that is in scope. Well, then what happens to everything, I didn't mention on the previous slide, but anything that provides a control to an in-scope device becomes in scope. So my DNS servers, my Active Directory, my patch management, my log management, on and on and on, are now in scope. And so the question is, well, how do we keep those things from contaminating even further? So we came up with this two-zone concept with the help of our QSA, where we have Zone A is our firm cardholder data environment. This is registers. This is endpoints where people are typing in credit cards, entering into our online forms, places where cardholder data is floating. Now, it's encrypted in transit, and everything is done as best the right way, but that's Zone A. And then Zone B is everything else, Active Directory. I ought to just go ahead and show you rather than. So our register backends are in Zone A. And then we're using Citrix to isolate and provide the minimal functionality, Citrix with thin clients on the endpoint, so where you can file SAQ, CVTs, virtual terminals. I won't talk about all the SAQs, but there's a lot. So Zone B has all of our Active Directory, DHCP, all the services which you need in order to run this other stuff. The decision that we made is that instead of running or dealing with the scope issues of having our campus Active Directory servers in scope and the change controls necessary, even though they increase your security, we weren't ready to make those changes at this point. We are building a whole separate inside the PCI kingdom, which is it's good and bad, mostly bad. Okay, so the way that data flows around in here is you can have these transactions go from the registers up to the register backends, and the register backends obviously have to clear out to our processor. So that communication is allowed. Each of these communication arrows, by the way, I have very specific. There's a firewall, obviously, here, but there's also a firewall between the zones and between the distributed VLANs. So I have firm policy points that I can say only these registers can access the register backends. Only the thin clients can access the Citrix backends. And only these backends are allowed to access very specific URLs. We're using our firewall provides URL filtering, so we're doing whitelisting for specific things. You can't go out and hit Facebook from the backend. You can't hit Facebook from the front, from the thin clients. None of that funny business. So it's as much isolation as possible. So then in order to get this separation, what we were told is that we need to get some two-factor. Basically what we do is we treat all of campus as a remote access into the environment.
with this firewall. So anyone who needs to do management of Active Directory, whatever, is going to do a two-factor authentication and then a split tunnel VPN, most likely some sort of VPN from using two-factor into Zone B. The key thing to notice is that you can't go from out of scope to Zone A. You can only go from out of scope to Zone B. And then if you need to manage your micros backends or whatever, we use micros, then you have to hop from some sort of management server in Zone B over to Zone A to do the management. Okay? So given that, this is what our new cloud of awesomeness looks like. We moved the registers down there to the distributed Zone A VLAN. That's our cardholder data environment. And we also pull management of the command and control into scope, but it's a considered Zone B. I come from a government background, and so for me, I'd like to think of them as classification levels, and you can't mix the two. But not everyone does. So I'd view these as completely separate classification areas, and then keeps campus completely out. And so this is our area which is in scope, and we exclude everything else. We can discuss that. There was discussions about if we needed a separate internet connection for our PCI environment, and that ended up not happening because any those authorizations which are going out from the data center Zone A to the internet are all encrypted, and it's the same bits that are going out the wire that could go through Afghanistan or they could go anywhere. So it's encrypted. So now I finally get to the title of my presentation. Don't worry, this is almost the end. A risk-based approach. So how are we going to do this? We have limited money. We use the same prioritized approach worksheet the PCI offers. And we adjust those most, I split them out into which are most critical pieces. Obviously building up this monstrosity of sorts, but getting my data center network ready, getting my distributed network ready. You have to build your foundation before you can put any applications on top of it. So that's obviously a most critical piece in order to address some of them. The other things in our most critical phase one were taking credit cards which are stored in the clear on-site databases. Those need to be dealt with and gone away. So we've dealt with most of those. We're still in the process. And also identified which ones aren't going to fit work with this solution. So our solution was if you're a register, you can go with micros. Otherwise, you're using a thin client to access Citrix. In an area, we had one POS, which wasn't micros, which didn't play very nice. And so our solution to that was, okay, fine, you get phone dialers, and we'll pull credit card functionality out. So, but it's a... That's not Aramark and not our dining facility. That's our museum where they don't get a lot of credit cards. And for them, they were so pleased that I didn't tell them that they had to throw their POS out that they gladly accepted the dial-up. So you identify your most critical risk, and then you start moving through. We've identified soft deadlines as far as what our target dates are, and those are kind of sliding around a little bit as we're getting the details starting to build out. You just start with the most critical stuff and then move on to your stuff which doesn't get you as much value as quickly and the stuff that's more expensive and then wrap up your loose ends. So some lessons learned. Like I said earlier, outsourcing those contracts don't always accept the PCI risk. In fact, in our experience, none of them did initially except for the TouchNet one because that's what they were doing. And 12.8.2 is where you want to look at that requirement that if you're outsourcing these things, they're saying, yes, we indeed do PCI and some verbiage that you like. And then you got to watch out for some higher scope creep. And so we said, okay, we'll do dialers. Well, okay, we'll do dialers and we'll plug them in over Wi-Fi. Well, no, that's not going to work. Okay, well, we'll plug them into the network. Well, no, we want to be able to file SAQBs. So we're only using dial-up dialers. If you want to use these other network ones, that's going to be a different situation. But in our case, the good thing is when we started doing the gap analysis, we imposed a moratorium on all new credit card processing across campus. We said, Uncle, we're not going to let anybody do this and until we get the new PCI environment set up, and then we'll accept new requests to do it, and we can modify our environment as necessary. There'll be costs associated, which we can pass on to you, and we'll go from there. Processing with the third parties, John mentioned it. We had, specifically in our call center development, they were calling people saying, hi, we'd like you to, not only was it, please go out and fill out the online form via TouchNet, which was a SAQ A type deal where we aren't involved in the process at all. They're entering their own cards. We can go. This was actively, hey, please give to Baylor. Sure, I can take your credit card, and let me enter it into the thing. Well, that workstation, even though it's entering into the same online form, which is secured and off-site, what do I do about the security of this laptop that they were using, or desktop? There's keyloggers. There's, you know, what's going on here? So that was a major thing. That's a major headache, too. That's why we're doing the Citrix build-out, and we're putting a lot of infrastructure into doing that. But that was in our interpretation from our QSA. But I agree with Scott. As much as we can get outsourced into the TouchNet, we've been doing. It's just for us, it's carving out who's actually entering them and where are those being typed in. We also had some compliant software that said it could do was PADSS validated, but it wasn't configured even remotely correctly. And it blows me away that they even sell software that can be done this way. We were talking credit cards being transmitted in the clear type of issues, and so
major vendors,
yeah. So I helped them remediate that a little bit, and we're moving forward. And then there's the non-compliant software, which is touching credit cards, and then there's on top of it, and I don't even have what about all the Excel spreadsheets that get pushed out? And one of the requirements of PCI 2.0 is that you have to really validate that your cardholder data environment is correctly scoped. And so we drew this nice little red box in the bottom, say this is our cardholder data environment. But at least annually, you have to go out and say, see, we're showing that all of our credit cards are down here. And so one of our initiatives to do that is going to be running an identity finder, or actually identity finder specifically, out on the workstations in an automated manner, looking for credit cards and reporting back, showing, look, we don't have any credit cards out there. Now, that'll involve one step earlier, which is, look, we have some. We need to get those deleted, and then we can show they're not out there. So that is all I have. Any questions?
Adam?
Yes?
This is Shannon, the voice coming
from the sky.
Whoa,
there you are.
I do have a couple of questions that came in from the online audience. They go back a little ways, and they're for both sets of you all.
Great.
The first one is coming from Cheryl at Emporia State University. And she says, and this goes back quite a ways, I think, but did I understand that you, and this is for the University of Delaware, sorry, did I understand that they use a payment processing center that charges a flat fee for every charge? So if I paid $5 to park in the garage via a credit card, does that mean there would be the same $25 charge as it would be if I paid a tuition of $1,000?
No, I'm sorry if that's the way it came across. It's not a flat rate, and it's not for every charge. It's the charges where we pass, I guess I gotta be careful about the words, the charges where the user incurs an additional fee is for tuition only. So if they're in a garage for parking, we absorb those fees and those costs. It's tuition only. When we did our calculations on, you know, prior to doing anything with CashNet, and we don't even have this live yet. We're still in the process of developing it. We did not take credit cards for tuition at all. So you want to come to university, ACH, write us a check, but not credit card. Through this mechanism that CashNet made available, what they do is they calculate what the actual credit card fees we would incur would be and add that on top so that we net out with the actual fee that we want to charge.
Okay, and the next question is from Cheryl again, and this is for Baylor. If a kiosk computer is set up for students to pay online near the cashier's window, is that computer, quote, in scope, end quote? We use hosted TouchNet applications, so the student is just using the browser window, encrypted transmit to TouchNet server to pay tuition / bill.
Okay, so I'm still discussing this with my QSI, because we have that situation where we have some email kiosks, which have been, and we actually discussed this in the pre-conference seminar yesterday with Walt. We have some email kiosks which are in the area of the cashier's office. Our cashiers don't take credit cards for the students. They're supposed to pay their tuition bills online. And they have pointed them to those kiosks and said, oh, sure, you can pay them over there. And so our QSA is saying those are in scope, but so there becomes this, it's an open debate with us right now because, okay, so what if I have my cashiers no longer point people there? That helps a little bit. And then, but these are 50 feet away. Okay, so let's move them 200 feet away. Is that sufficient? No. How about 100 feet away? Or 1,000 feet away, you know? So where is the line between, is a lab, is a student lab in scope? Because students can pay credit cards on university-owned stuff. We take the opinion that it isn't. And so we are currently in the process of trying to figure out what that is. And that seems to be an area of grayness with, we discussed it yesterday, of if, is it a multipurpose device? That, is it just used for paying credit cards and it's locked down? Well, then it's clearly a payment device. Is it also used for email and other things? Maybe not, but that also increases the risk because you're accessing Facebook or whatever from it. So that's a big, I don't know. 173? Great. Find it. Is there any more from online?
No, thank you, but I did want to share. There's still 42 people, 42 online sessions right now, many with, several people in the room.
You.
So you're keeping people awake and alive across the
nation.
Only
two people are asleep, so we're good. Yeah.
Why don't you just put one in your Citrix environment right next to the cashier's desk?
Yeah.
Use that one. That one's clearly in scope. Don't go anywhere else.
So the question is for online folk, why don't you just put a Citrix thin client there right next to the cashiers? Well, that's been discussed. Part of the issue is since we're separating our AD environment into PCI and you have to log who's accessing all instances, I'm only going to have user IDs for the people that are supposed to use credit card stuff. I'm not going to replicate all of my student accounts into the PCI environment. I don't want to if I can avoid it. And so that's I can't have an open payment terminal that I'm not logging who's there. And so it's that's a sticky business. That's been discussed. So another question over here? Yep.
So I saw you have distributed VLANs around the campus for your stuff that's scoped and out of scope. Are those sharing either 2.1Q trunks or are they going over separate infrastructure?
They're sharing the same trunks, but they're separate VLANs.
USA said okay so far.
Internal segmentation is different than external segmentation. Yes. So VLANs, the QSA, the approach has always been that VLANs can be adequately locked down to create segmentation. It's not all VLANs are, but it can be done.
And then we're doing port audits.
Not security.
We're doing port audits on which ports are being turned on specific VLANs and make sure that those are only to the correct areas and physical security around all those pieces.
Yeah, but in our environment, that is a secured network. It's a separate network from our main campus network. He mentioned a command and control network. That's a parallel network that we've been building out on campus for higher security.
So it only shares fiber with our fire alarm system, those types of critical level things. It's not... So, and that's all physical secured anyways, and so it's not like my students are traversing the same VLAN trunk as this stuff. It is separate fiber, but it shares with non-scoped.
At UD, we actually would have taken that approach, but when we did our analysis at some of the remote sites, they have smaller and older switches that couldn't handle any more VLANs than they already had. So we were looking at having to put a device in there anyway. So we said, let's make it a VPN. It makes it a little bit cleaner. You're already adding a device, you're going to pay the money. And actually, the VPN devices that we put in there are actually cheaper than the nicer end switches, yeah.
Are you using GRE tunnels or?
Well, I'll let you know when it's done.
And on the port auditing, are you tying specific MAC addresses for the devices to ports to that level, or are you just auditing?
So we're not doing it yet. This is still being built out, and there's been the question of whether or not that's going to be accessed just by change control and auditing or lockdown, MAC lockdown. We can do MAC lockdown, and I'd imagine that we're going to go that route as we tighten the screws a little tighter.
This is sort of for Scott.
Yes.
A number of the questions the Baylor folks have already answered have to do with not them deciding to keep things in-house, but how you deal with web interfaces or phone orders. Corner cases that are not a customer using the web interface at home.
Okay.
And none of those really go away when you actually successfully outsource. So, do you guys really not do phone orders? Do you do phone orders over dial-up terminals?
The question for the web people is how do we deal with people calling in for phone orders
when they're not sitting at home and it's not your traditional consumer. I like to think the Amazon scenario where it's not a person just sitting at home and ordering.
And also just in general, the corner cases
associated with it. A lot of it was helped because we don't do tuition, so you weren't calling in to pay your tuition bill over the phone. So that helped a lot because we just didn't take it for a credit card. The only places we really were doing it that you would conceivably call in, because you're not going to call and order into the dining hall. I mean, you show up at the dining hall and you eat, was for our development office, which went to Ruffalo Cody, and it's staffed with Ruffalo Cody employees. I mean, they hire UD students frequently, but they're employed by Ruffalo Cody, not by the university. On a separate segment that we gave to them, again, using that ISP approach that, you know, here's your network, just like any other hosting provider would do. So you can call into there, and that was all in scope, but it's isolated into that call center. Same thing with our ticketing. I don't know how big Baylor is, but we have basically one major athletic field. Now, there's indoor and outdoor facilities, but they're all co-located real close to each other. So we have really one ticketing booth. So you walk in, same situation, but with Ticketmaster. Here's the network. All the systems are on Ticketmaster's network. Difference is they are our employees, but segmentation is really a network issue, not who they're employed by. So if you call in an order because I want to buy season tickets, you're calling and they're hitting computers that are dedicated for ticket purchasing and that function on the segmented VLAN. Those are the other than our professional continuing studies who would take orders, what we're doing is migrating them to a CashNet function so that when they do call in to say, I want to take a course, that that person will be just logging into a CashNet screen, which is hosted outside our network. We haven't figured out how the scopeness of the person entering the order, but it's a desktop PC, so it's not going to be difficult to deal with whatever we do.
So we're using XenApp specifically to publish out IE for when they're accessing TouchNet directly. So most our development is all IE. And then for our athletic ticketing, we're publishing out the virtual terminal, the application that they're seeing.
Can they access that from just
normal? No. They access only from in-scope devices, specifically only from the thin clients. The nice thing about the thin clients is the interpretation of our QSA and that I've been hearing around is since it's such a locked-down device, you can't run AV on it, you can't run log, you can't do anything on it, and I'm disabling USB ports, I'm disabling all the things on that thin client, and so then I pull the most of my scope logging AV auditing to my Citrix environment, which is nice to do because I only have to do it once or once per farm. Yes, sir?
Can you talk a little bit about your physical security and you house all your servers in your data center and access and you have vendors that are supporting? How do you control that? The camera stuff?
Yeah, so the question is, what do you do about physical security? So we access it all, we house all the servers inside our data center, which have, we have cameras in our data center facility. We have just one factor authentication, card swipe access, although there's discussion of future access. And then, so your question was, what about vendors?
Yeah, about vendors. If a third party help manage, like maybe your food service.
Aramark? So we run the micro server entirely of our own personnel. Although there are Aramark people who need access to like change menus and such like that, we provide them thin client Citrix and their applications hosted out via Citrix. Those are onesie twosie.
Yeah, we don't allow any physical access to the servers in those cases.
And then
other than IT personnel.
Okay, so it's your own people that
yeah.
only have physical access.
Yes. Right. And so in a case where you have to have support, for example, micros, we need to talk. They need a WebEx in was the standard solution we keep that locked down in the firewall until that situation occurs. Then it's open specifically. We have URL filtering that only allows it to go to the WebEx. It's only for a limited time. Baylor personnel watch the whole session, and it gets shut down. The firewall call gets shut down. It's initiated outbound.
Okay.
So the key thing with two-factor is when it's coming into the environment from out of scope. So we're not listening and then letting someone initiate the call in. We are initiating the call out. Again, that's theoretical. It hasn't quite happened yet. But we've been doing that on our Micros environment for a long time anyways.
We have another question coming in from online. It's a question for Delaware, and it's from the University of Vermont Information Security Operations team and guests. So they're up kind of late watching, so say hi.
Hi.
The question is, does providing a segment of your network to third parties make you a service provider subject to SAQ space D? Is that SAC-D? I don't know. I'm learning a lot here, by the way.
So are we a service provider to them?
Yes.
Meaning to the third party.
Yeah.
We would probably be considered, yeah, I would think so, but they haven't come to us and asked us for anything yet, so it's their compliance requirement, and I'm not looking for more work to do. So.
I will comment on that further. Actually, Aramark had come to us
several years ago. Can you get closer to the mic? Sorry.
Aramark had come to us several years ago with that question, saying, hey, you guys are running the network that our point-of-sale system is on. Will you sign this document saying you're PCI compliant? And that was where the big red flag went up all of a sudden, because that makes us a payment processor, because we're providing the infrastructure for them to actually process cards on, and pushed us immediately to a level one, which we had no interest in being at. So that's where you have to be real careful, is if you start providing services so that a third party can then process transactions, it gets really sticky. Similarly, where somebody maybe you're having running a system putting their merchant ID in the background, which is how our solution was being run with Micros. It was Aramark merchant IDs in the background. All of a sudden, you're a payment processor on behalf of that third party. And I know a lot of institutions in the country are doing very similar things. So you have to evaluate extremely deep into these solutions to make sure that you're covering all your bases.
For the record, UD Aramark, it's UD merchant accounts. So
yeah,
we didn't have that.
And we have switched to that since, Baylor. Yep.
Scott, I have a question.
Yes.
I thought I heard you say this. I was wondering if you could give the basis, but something about disabling the credit card, the ability to take credit cards to the Micros system?
Yeah, there's functionality within Micros where it's set up. I don't know if Micros advertises it, but you can configure it to indicate external credit card sale within the Micros software. So, you know, you can swipe the credit card swiper, but when you hit the credit card button, it's not reading the card swipe. In our case, the swipe still works for gift cards because the restaurant does give out gift cards and they can use it for that. But when they swipe it for, it just doesn't do anything. They have to hit a button to say, similar to a cash sale, to say I took the money, I tendered the money, but they just hit the credit card button instead of the cash button. Yes, yeah, so just a standard dial-up terminal, yeah.
One thing to watch out for, from our perspective, on our Micros, we have the ability to swipe, and we're using the Micros system, but swipe credit cards or your Bear ID, so you can do a declining balance from their student account. This is a Bear ID, and then they swiped a credit card, then that credit card goes zinging out to our Bear Bucks authorization, and then with a quick little audit, I found we've been storing credit cards that have been misswiped, just the numbers, and so that's a major issue. So we're working with Micros to do a validation on the credit card or validation on the Bear Bucks number that goes out to verify this looks like a Bear Bucks number before it hits there. Right now, a compensating control that we've implemented is we have on the failed transaction log, If it doesn't look like it, it just writes zeros. That's still an issue because it's going outside of this in scope, and we don't want to have debold in scope. So that's just a little gotcha to watch out for. And then the question starts coming up, well, what about our copiers on campus that accept Bear Bucks only? What's to prevent people from going out and swiping their credit cards all over? Or what's to prevent me from swiping a credit card on a
access to a door, for example. And the guidance we have is we can't fix stupid, and if these people are trying to log in with their credit cards, we won't store them. If they don't look correct, we won't store them in the fail log or authentication log, but we won't. There's nothing we can do to keep it from getting there. Although we have discussed putting "this is not a credit card reader" underneath different things.
That's and we had the same question, but ours was for vending machines.
Yeah.
Yep. And that's what we're probably going to do is just put a little sign on the vending machine that says "does not accept credit cards" or something like that.
You still have to try to fix
stupid. Yeah.
Don't then, we all? Isn't that our job?
We can say we tried.
We still have 10 minutes in the session.
In our university, I've caught this, our ID center is actually merging the card with the bank that's on campus. It's
We're set up that way too, so you can use it as an ATM card?
Yeah, so it's a Visa, card, say you might use it for like Wells Fargo or something.
So if your ID card, he was talking about merging with the banks. If your ID card is a branded Visa, then you'd be in trouble because anytime that needs to be dealt with as if it's PCI. In our case, those aren't branded cards. Those are specifically just separate cards. Everybody it just looks like this. It's just it's a magstripe card, but it doesn't have any Visa signature. If you have Visa on it, it has to become, it's a PCI.
I've been catching that, it's got two. It can serve as, something that, like you said, your verified.
So this can, but only on campus. If it has a little Visa bird on it, or MasterCard or whatever, you're in trouble because then it's going
to
be.
Yeah, that's what we're trying to figure out.
Yeah, you'd use the same way as Baylor. There are true ATM cards, a unique number. It's not a Visa.
Yeah, we were consulting. It's kind of one of those things I just happened to see the advertising. You want to merge the two cards, convenience.
Yeah.
And IT was it.
I'd almost see if you could undo that decision.
Because the advantage is you can use the card anywhere Visa is accepted, but how many of students really need to do that if it's accepted on campus everywhere you need it? Why would they need to use it? They can always whip out the one that was issued by the bank and use that one instead.
Well, I had a coworker who uses the card, and we were at a local Chinese restaurant. She was using that card.
So one thing we do is we have our BareBucks program. We partnered with local businesses in the area, so they will take the declining balance card. But that cost is on them. They deal. That's a separate deal, and that's not PCI. Thank goodness. Yeah. Sorry. Any other days I can ruin?
Welcome to PCI.
Any other online questions from our online crew?
So one of the things that we've also talked with people on, when you're dealing with dial-up terminals, a lot of things get really easy from PCI perspective when you start dealing with a dial-up terminal. Realize that as universities are all moving to voice over IP, you can have additional issues if you're plugging that dial-up terminal into then a voice over IP connection. So start thinking about those processes, as well as with people taking credit cards over the phone. If they're using a voice over IP handset for that conversation, you can just bring that whole network into scope immediately. So you want to make sure to be thinking about those things.
So on that, what if your telephone service provider outside the university is voice over IP?
It's outside of your scope.
You're responsible for your barrier. So you're responsible up to what you own.
Yeah, but if they're bringing network lines into your building to facilitate the VoIP phones, then you have some of it on your network. And it will be wherever those connections are made.
The DMARC.
Just keep it outside of the DMARC.
Yeah. Traditionally, you'll use separate internet connections to talk to your VoIP. You won't share it with your existing one. So that VoIP one may be in scope, and then at least your rest of your network is not.
I'd thought about this before, but Walt brought up yesterday is PCI requirement zero, which is don't have scope if you don't need to. So the easiest way to become compliant with the device is to get it out of scope. And so that was what we were doing, trying to carve it down, but just a general concept of trying to reduce that scope down as much as you can. And then the other quote was AVSD, anything but SAC-D. If you can do SAC-B for those the swipers that are dial-up, or SAC-CVTs, which we're doing with our thin clients,
The require, even though it's still required to be PCI compliant, the validation of that and what you have to attest to on your signing are significantly reduced.
Now, we had a different response from our bank because they combined all our merchant accounts, and since some of them were SAQD, they all became. We couldn't file separate SAQs depending upon the merchant account and how it's used. We had to do a consolidated report, and the net sum was the D.
Right. And so we're in the process right now of discussing with the bank to show, allow us, because we have different ways. So you can run an SAQA for your TouchNet ones that I don't touch at all. And so we're trying to get our bank, and we haven't successfully worked, but trying to get our bank to accept those different ones for different types, carve out different classes of credit cards that we're accepting. And so that way we can show we're doing the right thing for this class, and then this class where it's SAC-D, it has to be done the right way. My Zone A data center ones are going to be Class D type devices, perhaps, and so I need to show the right thing there, but I don't have to fill out a SAC-D for the way TouchNet's doing it.
One thing I want to add before we end it, trying to be the optimist and the one that has to find the money and the resources to help these guys out. One of the approaches I liked is John keeps on saying, it's not about security, it's about compliance, okay? But the solution they're putting in place has far-reaching ramifications for us in a positive effect. So the foundation that these guys are building for PCI, we're going to be able to build a lot more stuff on, using our Citrix, using our two-factor authentication like that. So I keep on reminding me of that each time they come and ask for more money and stuff like that.
So to be clear, when he says using Citrix, it's going to be using a different Citrix. It won't be using the Inscope Citrix. But the expertise that we have and our server guys knowing how to run it, we can stand it up in other ways, and the learning curve will go a lot faster.
And to add to what Bob says, putting on my QASA days hat, it was frequently I would have done a gap assessment going in, similar to what you had done, showed them what to do. They set up that environment, and then you come back a year or two later to do the follow-up assessment, and you find out they decided to apply a lot of the things to everything because they found out it was more work to maintain two different operational models. Yep. I mean, whether it was good or bad for security, it was just easier to say, well, let's just make everything go through change of control. Well, let's just log everything, because it just was easier in the end to manage it that way than to try and say, well, this stuff we have to log, that stuff we don't. Every time a system got upgraded, got replaced, having to make a decision, what do I do? Is it in scope? If you just do it to everything. And then that wasn't even me influencing it. It was just their own conclusions that they came to very frequently.
There's an end of the tunnel?
I'd say we've been working on this probably 18 months now.
Yeah.
18 months. I'd say we probably have at least another 12 to 18 months to really feel like we're where we want to be on everything. But then it's an ongoing issue. I mean, new stuff's coming in. New PCI requirements are being released. I mean, we've all just gotten this PCI 2.0 requirement dropped on us. As far as checking for out-of-scope data. So it's going to be something I think we just actually have resources that are dedicated to these environments.
The key is going to be the resources. And that's why when they talked about forming this committee that meets, what is it, monthly?
Bi-weekly.
It's very important to get the higher-ups to understand. When we've got the finance treasurer on our side, that helps me out. I don't have to find as much money as I thought I would have to. So it'll vary on how much traction that you have and if the university takes it seriously and like that. It's just a resource hog. I mean, it just will gobble you up.
I'm going on 2 years. I did my own assessment, haven't been a QSA, and we're still not there. So we haven't submitted our first SAQ yet.
That's where you put the optimist hat on.
But we will one day.
Or we'll all stop processing credit cards, one of the two, right?
And somebody else will make that decision for you.
Yes, that's exactly right.
Which is the good news.